We're into the questions of Ephesians chapter 5. If you have those, please get them out. If you do not have a copy of them, I have some hard copies here. They're on the board. We've studied these first 21 verses in some detail. One of the things, as most of you know, with review questions, as far as I am concerned, I don't necessarily like to reteach everything unless it's necessary. If you have a question on something, this is primarily for a review to help us to work at home and have some things that will help us. Number one, I'll just go around the class to skip around at those that would like to participate. If you have the answers, raise your hand and we'll go from there. Number one, what are we told about God's actions in chapter 4, verse 32, that we are to imitate? Terry? All right, these are characteristics that we must develop. Number two, Peggy, what does it mean to walk in love? All right, it's a course of life. It's not just a step. Number three, identify other Bible incidences that are referred to as, quote, an odor of a sweet smell or a sweet savor. There are a number. I don't necessarily want all of them, but if you have one or two, that would be helpful. What's described in Scripture as an odor of a sweet smell? Carolyn? Yes, you may remember when Noah came forth from the ark. One of the first things that he did was to prepare an altar, and he offered a sacrifice that is referred to in those terms. Interesting, you would make the point, the priest offerings of Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 9 were also referred to in those terms. There's another sacrifice that I'd like for us to get. Yes, Chris. Jesus himself, yes. And what would be the text identifying that? Well, Ephesians 5, yes. That would work. I was thinking of 2 Corinthians 5, yes, verse 21 would do that for us. And, of course, we could kick back to the Old Testament prophet Isaiah as he describes those things in Isaiah chapter 53. Number 4. In verses 3 through 8, identify the things children of light do not do. Children of light do not do. Verses 3 through 8. Anybody? Don't everybody jump at once. All right, Lynn, thank you. Good to see your hand. All right. Very good. It's not an exhaustive list. Children, that's right. Children of God are not to walk this way. Number five. In verses 8b through verse 14, identify the things the children of light do. Anybody? Lynn? Yes. Right. All right. And that involves a number of qualities. Again, not an exhaustive list. Peggy?
In verse 10, here it says that we are to have no fellowship with unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even reprove them. And years ago, I looked up reprove in a dictionary, and one definition for it is exposing.
Yep. True. Okay, that's true. Instead of those things, Lynn, that you identified in the previous question, things that children of light do not do, You'll notice by way of contrast in verse 4, he said, rather giving of thanks. This was one of the things that Paul identified in the Roman letter, the first chapter, that began to take them in the wrong direction. That's right. That's right. All of these characteristics are things that children of light do. Did any of you think about in verse 14 the aspect of waking up? Sometimes children of light just have to inspect ourselves and see if we need to make some changes. Yes. Galatians 1:10, I believe it is. Yeah, that's right. Any other comment or question just here? All right, David? Well, all of these qualities, yeah, goodness, righteousness, proving what is right, all of these children of light participate in. Number 6, why is jesting forbidden? And if those of you who are reading out of the New American Standard Translation, you'll notice that the word is not just jesting, it's described as coarse jesting. First of all, let's identify what it is and then why it's forbidden. Carolyn?
I would say it is joking about things that are inappropriate to be talking about.
All right.
Things of an immoral nature.
That's right. That's right. Things that have insinuations that
and
ought not have.
If that would be wrong, if it's making light of something that's evil, then
you
should never take lightly or think that it's humorous.
All right. We can't laugh at that kind of sin. Or any kind of sin, but we can't laugh at things that are sinful. Yes. Jenny?
One of the verses that I think of when it comes to joking is Proverbs 26:18-19, which I'm sure several other people have written down for this one. But you have to be careful what you're saying. You can't throw the firebrand arrows in death and expect it to be okay if you say that you're joking.
That's right. That's right. And what Jenny's talking about simply is gouging somebody and then say, oh, I was just kidding. It's not funny. No, it's not funny. Or saying something that's improper and then seeing a shock on people's face. I was just making fun. No, that's not proper. So this is what we're talking about. Now, does that indicate that all humor is wrong? No, oh no, it's good. And of course there are statements in the Proverbs about laughter and how that it's somewhat medicine for the soul, as it were. Number 7, why is a covetous man also an idolater? Chris? That's right. Becomes your God. That's right. Number 8, in what way does Paul identify the kingdom as the kingdom of Christ and God? Now, I don't mean to have an ambiguous question, but if you have thought about that and have a response, I'd be interested in hearing it. In what way does Paul identify the kingdom as the kingdom of Christ and God? Look at your text. Verse 5. For ye know this of a surety, that no fornicator, no unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Now take a stab at that. What's Paul saying? Terry? trying. So when Paul describes these that are walking as children of darkness, just to put it plain, you can't go to heaven and do these things. Now, when we talk about the kingdom of Christ and God, we're not talking about two separate kingdoms, not two separate rewards. Jenny. Well, I'm glad to hear you thought about it that way. I had considered that as well, and it's a delight to know that you plowed that deep. Sometimes folks don't. Who are the sons of disobedience? The sons of disobedience. Anybody? That's good, isn't it? Yeah, those who practice these things that are identified in this text there, beginning at verse 3. Why are words that attempt to excuse immorality and covetousness called empty words? Now, I want that in this context. Why does the writer call them empty words or vain? Lynn? There isn't. It's empty promises. And we looked at the... That's right. And folks say, you can do this and God won't do anything, as the Old Testament prophets did, recorded in Jeremiah 23. Peace, peace, when there is no peace. You can do this, but there is no consequence. And that's empty. It's vain. It's foolishness. Number 11, what relationship are the children of light to have with the sons of disobedience? Peggy? None. Isn't that appalling? None. We don't become partakers with them. All right. All right, partakers. That's the key. Right. No, that won't work. Right. Well, verse 11 tells us to have no fellowship with them, but rather even reprove them. So to have no relationship really wouldn't be the point, I suppose. But you don't have participation in those things. You don't have fellowship in those things. Now, that raises the question, and I want us to consider it just here, regarding those who are sons of disobedience. Is it possible that there would be sons of disobedience in the Lord's church? That's what he's talking about here in this context. Now, question, does that mean then that those who are sons of disobedience within the Lord's church, that we don't have any relationship at all with them? Now, the apostle writing to those in Thessalonica, go ahead, Peggy. Yeah. That's right. Can't do that, no. Can't do that, no. No, can't do that. Paul said to those in Thessalonica not to treat them as an enemy, but admonish them as a brother. Now, as Paul wrote to those in Corinth regarding the fornicator that was tolerated or fellowshipped among them in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, as he elaborates on that in the context following the discussion of that particular fellow, he said, not at all meaning fornicators of the world. He said, for then you must needs go out of the world. But he's talking about those who are in fellowship with the brethren. They're not to be considered in fellowship with the brethren. According to chapter 5, verse 8, what were we or what were we before conversion, and what have we become? Richard?
Well, we're darkness, and now we're light.
That's right.
So that's since Jesus is the light, we're walking with him and after.
All right, very good. How are we referred to as children of light? How does one become a child of light? You've started that, Richard. Just go ahead and pursue it. Really, you did. Uh-huh. Number 13. Multitasking. Yeah. Yeah, 1 John 1:5. That's right. John chapter 1, I believe it is, what, verse 17 or thereabouts? Now, it might be 14. As we talk about becoming children of light, and Richard has alluded to the Gospel of John, have you noticed in John's writing, I'm getting us off our subject, I'll pull back in just a moment. Have you noticed in the writings of John, whether it be the Gospel of John or the Epistles of John, that the theme of light and life characterizes all of John's writing? And so you want to look for those things as you're reading the writings of John. Now, how does one become a child of light? Primarily, we've answered that. You walk in the light. But at what point, then, do you become a child of God? Well, it's when you obey the gospel, and that's a given to this class. Number 14, how does the saint manifest the fruit of light? Number 14, verse 9. Goodness, righteousness, and truth. Number 15. Should everything that is done by those who practice darkness be spoken of openly? Jenny? Okay. All right. Richard?
Well, I was going to say also that when it says here, that we're talking about the end of verse 11, but rather even reprove them. The thing is that the gospel tells us to reprove people with love, and that we reprove people in a way that they will understand and accept what we have to say. If you get up and yell and scream in their face, you're not going to, that's not a reproof.
No. Consider that then in the context of verse 12, the things that are done in secret, he said, it's a shame even to speak of. It's shameful. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay, good. I'm glad we got there. Number 16, how far can we go in avoiding wicked people in order that we may not or may have no fellowship with the works of darkness? I think we touched on that a moment ago in 1 Corinthians 5. How far do you go? Where's my rubber chicken? I know it. How far can we go in avoiding wicked people in order that we may have no fellowship with the works of darkness? Well, you can't go out of the world. You live in the world. So that's not a possibility. But as it pertains to those who are considered brethren, we are not to have fellowship with them. And that's what Paul is writing about in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. They were tolerating fornication among them, even so that was not characterized of the Gentiles. And that was unacceptable.
I think how important this particular series of verses is here
That's true. That's true. Now, we've used the illustration of 1 Corinthians 5 repeatedly, and we have emphasized the sin of fornication in our speaking of this. Let us understand that we're generalizing all of these with that terminology. We're not just limiting our discussion to that, because Paul gives an elaborate list, not detailed or not exhaustive, but an elaborate list in 1 Corinthians 5, as well as he does here in Ephesians chapter 5. What does it mean to reprove? Is it enough just to ignore evil? Okay. They were. And that's intolerable. Couldn't do that. So it's not enough just to ignore or be indifferent to it and say, well, I don't do that. But we have to reprove it. And what does that mean, Terry? All right.
So it's about convincing someone, which means that you're teaching.
All right. And Paul said that to Timothy in the familiar text of 2 Timothy 4, verse 2. Preach the word. Be urgent in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. That don't fix anything, does it? No, we're not doing anybody any favors. Can men arise from the dead by their own choice? And when does Christ shine upon us? What's it mean, first of all, to rise from the dead in this context? Awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall shine upon thee. Verse 14. Paul had already identified these Ephesians regarding their former manner of life as being dead in their trespasses and sins. But I think we've talked about this perhaps, was it Sunday morning, that those who are baptized into Christ are raised to walk a new life in Christ. Paul describes us as new creatures in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 17. But once one has been raised from, as we use the expression, the grave of baptism, the old life has been put off and a new life is to be put on, does that then mean that he can't be dead again? Well, see, that's a consequence of sin. If he walks in darkness, what condition is he in, whether he's ever obeyed the gospel or not? He's lost. Now, that's the key that we want to see. Number 19, why does the fact that the days are evil make it necessary to be careful how we use our time? Anybody? Carolyn? Well, that's right. We have to remember Satan never sleeps. He never leaves us alone. He's described as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He never sleeps. And so we have to make the best use of what time that we have because the days are evil. And, of course, temptation abounds on every hand And we have to be careful. Number 20, what determines whether our walk is wise or unwise? Is there any connection between the days being evil and our being foolish? I want you to think about that. First of all, what determines whether our walk is wise or unwise, Jenny? That works. That just works. It's not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. Which one's that? Yes. And there's a way that seemeth right unto a man. The end is death. Where's that? She's good, isn't she? Terry? Okay. Well, that's what determines whether our walk is wise or unwise. James talks about a wisdom that is from above. James chapter 3. And of course, the Apostle Paul is writing in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 about the wisdom of God being considered foolishness when compared to the wisdom of man. Yeah. That's right. Right. There is a wisdom from above, and we have to find out what that is. And we do that by studying. Is there any connection between the days being evil and our being foolish? Richard? Oh, I thought you were nodding. Number 20. Yeah, uh-huh. Now, would you mind to elaborate just a little bit? Dilemma.
Between, you know, what I would that I do not, what I would not that I do, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. That just indicates to me that the days are essentially equal. What we're looking for is the good days that happen after this one.
All right.
And the foolishness comes along with falling by the wayside, much like the sower received the story of the parable of the sower.
All right. Terry? That's right. That's right. If you participate in those things that characterize the walk of darkness, you're a fool. Yeah, you're a fool. Number 21, obviously it is not possible to buy back or redeem the time that we have wasted in the past. How then do we redeem the time because the days are evil? You've in principle answered that. Number 22, what results when one is drunk with wine? Text gives us a word. Riot. And what is that? All right. Confusion, rowdiness. I put in my notes a word that I wanted to throw out. Well, I'm trying to pronounce it. Exhilaration. When one is filled with alcohol, he does foolish things often. Now, does that mean that it's wrong to be excited about things? Well, no. But when one is filled with drink, when he's drunk, he does foolish things. The wisdom writer described that in Proverbs chapter 23. But when one is filled with the Spirit, what does he do? Well, first of all, what does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? Pardon me? I didn't hear you. It guides your life. Now the question then is raised, how does the Spirit guide our lives? All right, through the Word. That's the only way I know that we could say He guides us. Is through what he has to say. Now, there are manifestations of that. If one is drunk with wine, you've got exhilaration as a result of the wine. If one is filled with the Spirit, you have one who is exhilarated because of what? What excites him? Maybe we need a good dose of that in our study tonight. Because to be filled with the Spirit means something to you. It ought to do something for you. What does it mean, John? All right. All right. All right, now contrast that. Turn that thing around. Yeah. That's right. All right, that's right. So if we're filled with the Spirit, we're doing good things. And we're under the influence, as we use that terminology. But a point we want to be sure we've got a handle on is how that's accomplished. You see, we're not under the influence of the Spirit in the sense that the Spirit has just overwhelmed you and now you flap around on the floor for a little while. You see, that's not the point. To be filled with the Spirit means you've learned something. And you've put that into practice. And not only have you learned something that you want to practice, but you want others to practice that too. It fills you, as John has aptly stated. Terry? That's right. And contrasted to that is the character who is walking according to the light. He's filled with the Spirit, and he's following the things that the Spirit has revealed. And in our Romans study, you well recall from Romans the 8th chapter, about verse 14, I believe it is, where the writer talks about being led by the Spirit of God. How are we led by the Spirit of God? Well, he just overwhelms us and we flop around a little. No, that's not how we're led. He doesn't do something to you. How then does the Spirit lead you? Through the Word. That requires then something of you. If the Spirit is going to lead you, you have to know what he says. Yes, Richard. Richard.
Paul says to understand what the will of
the Lord is. That's right. And that's certainly in this context, yes. 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 That's exactly the point.
I was going to point out, this is out of curiosity here, that I noticed that the word excess that's used in the Greek here is asapia. I dare say that that's where we get the slang English term sop for a person that's been wondering.
Could be. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. Hadn't thought of that. That's probably right. Number 23, what is the difference, if any, between psalm, hymn, and spiritual song? Not much. Not much. Jenny?
I found a website called the Worship Corner.
Uh-oh, okay.
Take this with however much salt you can. But it says, in a specific sense, however, a psalm would contrast with a hymn. Similar to what we today call choruses, a psalm or song is generally simpler, shorter, more testimonial, and less theological than a hymn. A hymn would usually carry a greater sense of history. A psalm or a chorus would be more personal. A psalm is also more contemporary and has a shorter lifespan. The spiritual song is even more a song of the moment than a psalm. The spiritual song, which consists of spontaneous melodies and words inspired by the Holy Spirit and sung around a chord or a slowly moving chord progression, has been referred to as the song of angels because of its mystical, otherworldly quality.
And you're on the web right now? I will pull the plug. Okay. Oh, that's a whole lot of words to describe these three little words.
I would say that there are definitely there's different types of songs right in our songbook as well as others that are outside that. And some repeated words, the melody that kind of focuses your mind and then it maybe will follow with other words. Other songs are very complex poetry and full of theological truth. And so we do see those two different kinds. And I think they both have a place, you know, assuming that we've checked out the words and there's nothing amiss.
Well, that's true. Of course, encompassed in these three terms is the idea of praise, adoration, praise, giving glory to God, songs that are designed to teach, to admonish, to build up, to edify. And I'm not persuaded there is a remarkable difference between these three words. There might be a slight difference, but not a remarkable one. Yes. Exactly right. Exactly right. And we might note just here as well that when we consider psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, and of course this gets into the next question. Jenny? Oh, well, into the next question about the use of mechanical instruments of music. We'll talk about that. Go ahead. Well, now that's interesting, because there are things in the Psalms that indicate sacrifice that would void the sacrifice of Christ, that would advocate such things as burning incense and so forth. And these kind of things, of course, we don't practice because we're under the terms of the New Covenant. There are Psalms that fit the category of the things we're discussing here. We often sing, for example, Psalms 148. Hallelujah, praise Jehovah, and then Psalms 19, one of my favorites. But to use the word psalm in this context exclusively to talk about the Old Testament psalms is probably not the best definition. Number 24, upon what instrument is the Christian to sing and make melody to the Lord? What's the instrument? The harp. The harp. Now, there is a modern definition of the word psalo that includes the mechanical instrument of music. But the problem with that is the New Testament was not written in modern Greek. So what the word meant then is what the word is to mean now. Does that distinction, everybody see that distinction? We can't use modern day Greek words to define the language of the New Testament. But when we use the language of the New Testament and understand that it was written in Koine Greek, which shortly after it was written became a dead language. Now what does that mean? If it became a dead language, David?
Well, when that language stops, being dead, you can't go beyond that because it's not still changing. That's what it was.
The definitions were fixed. That's right. or modern-day Greek. Words tend to vary. Why do you suppose we have updated editions of dictionaries? Because words tend to vary from time to time. And, of course, a dead language, what it meant then is what it still means. And so we have to look for those definitions. Yes, Richard? That's interesting. Right.
And so it makes no difference whether we've got 5,000 usages of Koine Greek that show that they plucked on stringed instruments. If the New Testament doesn't say that, then that's not what it means.
All right. What I want to emphasize here, that's fine and that's accurate. But when we look at the word solo, you mentioned a portion of the definition of the word, to prick, to pluck, or to twang. And somebody says, well, there certainly then is the mechanical instrument of music, because as you look at stringed instruments, you prick, you pluck, or you twang them. But the instrument is not defined in this text as something that is mechanical, yet it is named. What is it that must be pricked, plucked, or twanged? The heart. The heart. All right.
So the plucking or twanging that may come from the generic definition of solo in the Koine Greek, as found in extra-biblical sources, is not shown here. It's simply shown that the instrument that's to be used in singing is that which makes melody in our hearts.
All right. The heart does. All right. That's right. Now, Jenny, you mentioned the authority class. We talked about this in the authority class. And as we look at this text, we see, yes, there is authority for singing. Now, if we are to play, we understand that we've got different kinds involved here. We've got singing and we've got playing. Did God specify the kind of music that is acceptable to Him? Yeah, He did. Now, maybe somebody knows more than I do, and that's probably the gist with most of us, or most of you. But when we think about kinds of music, can you think of any other kind besides mechanical or vocal? Somebody says the wind passing through the tree leaves. That's not what I'm talking about. Mechanical or vocal? Can you think of any other kind of music? But God tells us what kind. He specified the kind. I asked that question one time and somebody said, well, yeah, there is electronically generated music.
But
that's mechanical.
Yeah. All right. It is indeed. It is indeed. Yeah, about 600, as a matter of fact.
Randy mentioned once, too,
Well, that's right. And there's another thing, another element in this that I certainly want to make us aware of. We've thought about it and talked about it. What is the unique element of singing that does not exist in playing?
It has lyrics.
Has lyrics. Teaching. You've got words. And that's what's to be done here. Teach and admonish one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Jenny? I was waiting for that. Absolutely right.
Every time that you're trying to worship God in music, everyone would have to play something with strings. And so if, like, Paul and Silas are in jail singing hymns to each other, I don't think they were allowed to bring their guitar.
Okay.
One of the things that Shackle's thinking about.
Yeah. Wind blowing through the chains. Very good. That's right. That's right. All right, Richard.
I'd like to move quickly. One thing that too many people get mixed up on is that, well, this is referring to in the assembly. It is not referring to in the assembly.
Not exclusively. No.
Exclusively. It says that when you worship God, you do not do so with instruments of music.
Yeah. Now, that raises an interesting question because of an experience I've had in the past with someone. They argued that you cannot use Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16 to discuss singing in the assembly because these are generic. Last time I had a count, if you sing in the shower or if you sing at home or if you sing in the assembly, worship and praise to God is psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. So these passages are very much appropriate to talk about what we do in the assembly. However, they're not excluding other occasions where we might worship. Okay? David? Well, the Lord didn't say sing well. He said sing. And we can all do that. We can all do that. Well, two more questions. And we'll be through with the questions. We'll start with those two Sunday morning. We won't take a great deal of time with them, I don't think. We might, number 26, but be that as it may. Be sure you thought about those and read carefully. Read carefully. Verses 22 through verse 33. We'll talk about that in our next study.